Hello, this is Ms. He targets Trump, Tehran's leverage, and talks end with an agreement. President Donald Trump said Sunday the U.S. Navy would immediately begin a blockade of ships entering or leaving the Strait of Hormuz after U.S.-Iran ceasefire talks in Pakistan ended without an agreement. U.S. Central Command announced that it will blockade all Iranian ports beginning Monday at 10 a.m. Eastern. CENTCOM said the blockade will be enforced impartially against vessels of all nations. It said it would still allow ships traveling between non-Iranian ports to transit the Strait of Hormuz. Trump wants to weaken Iran's key leverage in the war after demanding that it reopen the strait to all global traffic on the waterway that was responsible for 20% of global oil shipping before fighting began. Traffic in the strait has been limited even in the days since the ceasefire. Marine trackers say over 40 commercial ships have crossed since the start of the ceasefire. A U.S. blockade could further rattle global energy markets. It's going to be all or none, and that's the way it is, Trump told Fox News. Trump said on social media that he told the Navy to seek and interdict every vessel in international waters that has paid a toll to Iran. No one who pays an illegal toll will have safe passage on the high seas, he said. Other nations would be involved, but did not name them. Freedom of peaceful navigation is a basic principle of international maritime trade. Iran's Revolutionary Guard later said the strait remained under Iran's full control and was open for non-military vessels, but military ones would get a forceful response, two semi-official Iranian news agencies reported. During the 21-hour talks, the U.S. military said two destroyers transited the strait ahead of mine-clearing work, a first since the war began. Iran denied it. Trump's plan to use the Navy to block the strait is unrealistic, and he will have to concede on some issues with Iran, said Andreas Krieg, a senior lecturer in security studies at King's College London. There isn't any tool in the toolbox in terms of military lever that he could use to get this his way, Krieg said. Trump said Tehran's nuclear ambitions were the core of the talks' failure. In comments to Fox News, he again threatened to strike civilian infrastructure. Parliament Speaker Mohammed Baghir Qualbaf, who led Iran's side, addressed Trump in a new statement on his return to Iran. If you fight, we will fight. The face-to-face talks that ended early Sunday were high-level negotiations between the longtime rivals since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Neither indicated what will happen after the ceasefire expires on April 22nd. We need to see an affirmative commitment that they will not seek a nuclear weapon, said Vice President J.D. Vance, leading the U.S. side. Iranian negotiators could not agree to all U.S. red lines, said a U.S. official who spoke on condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to describe positions on the record. These included Iran never obtaining a nuclear weapon, ending uranium enrichment, dismantling major enrichment facilities, and allowing retrieval of its highly enriched uranium, along with opening the Strait of Hormuz and ending funding for Hamas, Hezbollah, and Houthi rebels. Iranian officials said talks fell apart over two or three key issues, blaming what they called U.S. overreach. Qualbaf, who noted progress in negotiations, said it was time for the United States to decide whether it can gain our trust or not. Pakistani Foreign Minister Ishaq Dar said his country will try to facilitate a new dialogue in the coming days. Iran said it was open to continuing dialogue, state-run IRNA news agency reported. The European Union urged further diplomatic efforts. The foreign minister of Oman, located on the Strait of Hormuz's southern coast, called for parties to make painful concessions. The Kremlin said Russian President Vladimir Putin emphasized his readiness to help bring about a diplomatic settlement in a call with Iran's president. Iran's nuclear program was at the center of tensions long before the U.S. and Israel launched the war February 28th. The fighting has killed at least 3,000 people in Iran, 2,055 people in Lebanon, 23 in Israel, and more than a dozen in Gulf Arab states, a damaged infrastructure in half a dozen countries. Tehran has long denied seeking nuclear weapons, but insists on its right to a civilian nuclear program. The landmark 2015 nuclear deal, which Trump later pulled the U.S. out of, took well over a year of negotiations. Experts say Iran's stockpile of enriched uranium, though not weapons grade, is only a short technical step away. An Iranian diplomatic official speaking on condition of anonymity because of the sensitivity of closed-door talks denied that negotiations had failed over Iran's nuclear ambitions. Inside Iran, there was new exhaustion and anger after months of unrest that began with nationwide protests against economic issues and then political ones, followed by weeks of sheltering from U.S. and Israeli bombardment. We have never sought war, but if they try to win what they failed to win on the battlefield through talks, that's absolutely unacceptable, Mohammad Bajer Karami said in Tehran. Elsewhere in the region, airstrikes calmed over the past day except in Lebanon. Iran's 10-point proposal for the talks called for a halt to Israeli strikes on the Iranian-backed Hezbollah in Lebanon. Israeli has said the ceasefire did not apply there, but Iran and Pakistan said it did. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu visited parts of southern Lebanon under Israeli control Sunday for the first time since the current fighting. Attacks on southern Lebanon have intensified alongside the ground invasion renewed after Hezbollah launched rockets toward Israel in the war's opening days. Negotiations between Israel and Lebanon are expected to begin Tuesday in Washington after Israel's surprise announcement authorizing talks despite their lack of official relations. Israel wants Lebanon to assume responsibility for disarming Hezbollah, but the militant group has survived efforts to curb its strength for decades. The day the Iran ceasefire was announced, Israel pounded Beirut with airstrikes, killing more than 300 people, according to the health ministry. Lebanon's state-run news agency reported 6 people were killed Sunday in Morab village near the coastal city of Tyre. Our next front page article, soybeans up as corn falls. Farmers weigh risks timing as input costs climb in 2026. Farmers plan to plant less corn and more soybeans in 2026 compared to last year, according to recent estimates from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Meanwhile, military action in Iran keeps pumping up fertilizer and fuel prices in another hit to the struggling U.S. ag sector. The USDA Prospective Plantings Report released March 31st forecasts 95.3 million acres for corn, a 3% drop from 2025, and 84.7 million acres for soybeans, a 4% increase from 2025. At the same time, farmers are also keeping tabs on fertilizer and fuel prices. Fertilizer price increases since late February ranged from 20% to 25% for anhydrous ammonia to more than 40% for urea, the University of Illinois FarmDoc website reported April 7th. The geopolitical uncertainty from the Iran war has accelerated crop price gains, Iowa State University Extension economist Chad Hart said in his March Outlook report. Currently, futures are pointing to an $4.80 corn price and a $11.20 soybean price, Hart said. Those gain in prices will likely be needed as the ongoing military conflict is also causing significant increases in energy prices. Farmers are already seeing sizable hikes in diesel prices and know that other agricultural input costs tend to move with energy prices. Planting dates in Illinois. The University of Illinois lists the following Illinois planting dates for insurance coverage. Corn, April 1st in the south, April 5th central, and April 10th northern Illinois. Optimal window, mid-April to early May, with soybeans often planted immediately before or alongside corn. Final corn insurance dates, May 31st, southernmost counties, to June 5th, rest of the state. Soybean, April 5th, south, April 10th, central, April 15th, northern Illinois. Final soybean insurance dates, June 15th, northern one-third, to June 20, rest of state. Farmers are already seeing sizable hikes in diesel prices and know that other agricultural input costs tend to move with energy prices. Early planting varies by region, with the USDA predicting farmers will plant 5% more soybean acres in 2026 due to projected higher prices. Early planting might provide an advantage to growers, said Andre F.B. Rees, University of Missouri statewide specialist in soybean farming systems. Missouri naturally gets earlier planting start than Illinois or Iowa. The planting season already started in some of the southeast regions and a few fields in the central north region, Rees said. He said early planting may mean different dates for farmers and regions. For instance, he said, planting before April 1st in the central north region would be extremely early. But don't wait too long, Rees recommended. For one, farmers don't want to finish harvesting their last fields too late in fall, he said. But research has also shown significant yield drops when farmers plant toward the end of May, Rees said. In 2025, Missouri soybean farmers produced record yields except on acres planted after May 17th. Recent Midwest rains were welcomed as the USDA reported 44% of corn and soybean acres as of March 31st were in moderate or more intense drought conditions in the United States. Rain, hail, and tornadoes came through Iowa, Missouri, and Illinois at the beginning of this month. Extra patience might be needed as farmers prepare for planting, said Mark Licht, Iowa State University Associate Professor and Extension Cropping Systems Specialist. With recent rains, field conditions are probably not ideal for field work, or at least field conditions need to be considered, he said. Once the calendar date falls into late March, some of the spring field operations are fair game to get any needed tillage, herbicide, and fertility applications made ahead of spring planting. Personally, I get nervous planting either corn or soybean ahead of April 10th, simply because we tend to have a spring frost, freeze, or snow in late April, or even occasionally as late as the first week of May. While he waits to plant soybeans and corn, north central Iowa farmer Doug Adams recently seeded 17 acres of oats while a neighbor planted 220 acres. Rain arrived soon after the planting. Now we could use some sun and more warmth, he said. Soil temp key to success. As spring planting nears, soil temperature is a top factor influencing successful soybean and corn planting, Lick said. While it's tempting to roll into the field the moment soil looks fit, making decisions based on both soil temperature and soil moisture can make the difference between a strong stand and a season-long struggle, Licht wrote in a March 26th column. Waiting for soil to reach appropriate temperatures and avoiding wet planting conditions almost always pays dividends in emergence uniformity and stand quality. He also suggested farmers weigh 3 to 7 day forecasts showing warming trends to avoid chilling damage. From late March through mid-April, there can be rapid air and soil temperature swings. Residue cover, soil color, and drainage all affect daily soil temperature fluctuations, Licht wrote. The Iowa Environmental Messenet is a tool to check daily soil temperature analysis maps using ISU Soil Moisture Network observations combined with bias-corrected NWS forecast model analysis. Trends can be viewed for the past 3 days as well as forecasted into the future using the GFS forecast model outputs. This data comes from weather stations at extension farms across Iowa with instruments that measure air temperature, solar radiation, precipitation, humidity, soil moisture, soil temperature, wind speed, and wind direction. Survey responses are down. Input from farmers in the prospective planting survey dropped 6.7% this spring from a year ago. The USDA reported 37.6% of farmers responded to this year's prospective planting survey compared to 44.3% last year. This decline is a record low for the March survey, according to the USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service. The USDA farmer relationship needs to be rebuilt, said Seth Meyer, from former USDA chief economist and director of University of Missouri's Food and Agricultural Policy Research Institute since January 1st. This has got to be a partnership between the data gatherers and the farmers, Meyer said. And now in local news, woman hurt in stabbing, Decatur police report. A woman has been arrested on obstructing charges after police said she reportedly stabbed another woman with a knife. Sergeant Adam Seifman with the Decatur Police Department said patrol officers were called just before 11:30 p.m. Friday to a home on East Hickory Street where they found a 23-year-old woman with a cut to a finger and a 1-inch stab wound to her upper back. She was later treated at hospital. Seifman said reports from the scene indicated the woman's conflict involved a man they had both had contact with. Seifman said on the day of the fight, the two women had met by chance while out drinking and appeared to forget their previous animosity and had been friendly with each other. That, however, didn't last. They had eventually parted and went their separate ways, and then the 30-year-old female started texting the 23-year-old again regarding pursuing a physical altercation, Seifman added. The younger woman showed up outside the older woman's home on East Hickory Street. The 23-year-old called her and stated she was outside and was going to unalive her, Seifman said. They had both engaged in conversation, and the 30-year-old female had spit in the face of the 23-year-old. The older woman was described as having grabbed a knife and tucked it into her clothes before the confrontation, but she later denied to the police that she had stabbed the younger woman. Seifman said neither combatant wanted to pursue charges against the other, but the older woman was arrested on an obstructing charge after police said she tried to run back inside her house after officers arrived. She was given with a notice to appear in court. Public safety. Fire crews worked to extinguish a house fire Saturday, April 11, 2026, in Niantic. The Decatur Fire Department responded to the scene, bringing the ladder truck to reach the top floor of the two-story home. Overheated equipment sparked a fire response at Archer Daniels Midland Company's West Plant late Sunday morning. They had a piece of equipment that had failed, overheated, and caused a little bit of smoke in a room out there, said Justin Kraus, a battalion chief with the Decatur Fire Department. When we got there, we found no fire, and we set up a fan so they could get the smoke out, Kraus said. He said firefighters were called at 11:30 a.m. to the plant in the 3700 block of East Division Street and remained on the scene for about 30 minutes. Crews battle Niantic house fire. Fire crews were called to extinguish a fire that sparked Saturday in a Niantic home. Six area fire departments responded Saturday afternoon to the two-story home in the 200 block of West North Street, including the Decatur Fire Department, which provided a ladder truck. Crews remained on the scene as of 6 p.m. Saturday, cutting holes in the roof and putting water on flames that could be seen coming out of the back of the home. Extensive fire and smoke damage was visible from the outside while crews continued to work. No further information was available by press time Sunday. A Clinton man accused of stabbing a woman. police have arrested a DeWitt County man accused of stabbing a woman outside of a convenience store on Friday afternoon in the Henry County community of Geneseo. Officers responded to the Casey's General Store, 100 Bester Drive, at 4:33 p.m. to investigate a report of a stabbing with a female victim and a male suspect, according to a news release from Geneseo Police Department. Officers located the woman, who was treated at the scene and then transported to a local hospital. Officers were able to locate the man suspected in the stabbing, who had left the scene on foot. Ilir Emiri, 31, of Clinton, was taken into custody without incident. Emiri was taken to a local hospital for treatment of a medical issue. When he was released from the hospital, Ilemi was booked into the Henry County Jail. He was arrested on suspicion of attempted murder and aggravated domestic battery. He is being held in the Henry County Jail pending a detention hearing. Emiri is currently on pretrial release in a battery case in central Illinois as well. On January 26, Clinton police arrested Emiri in an aggravated battery case. Emiri was released from the DeWitt County Jail on pretrial release on January 28. Emiri is charged in DeWitt County Circuit Court with two counts of Class II felony charges of aggravated battery, with one of those counts alleging strangulation. A jury trial in that case is scheduled for May 11th. Our next article, bills ruling rental fees, ICE detention advance. Springfield. The Illinois House on Wednesday approved legislation that would prohibit the federal government from operating a new immigration detention center within 1,500 feet of any home, school, daycare center, park, forest preserve, cemetery, or place of worship. House Bill 5024, sponsored by House Speaker Emanuel Chris Welch, Democrat, Hillside, passed on a largely partisan 72-35-2 roll call and now moves to the Illinois Senate for consideration. It was one of more than 50 bills advanced out of the chamber on Wednesday as the House begins several days of floor action. Welch's district includes Broadview, a west suburban village of about 8,000 that's home to an Immigration and Customs Enforcement Processing Center that became a focal point for protesters during Operation Midway Blitz last year. The facility wouldn't be affected by the measure. The detention center in Broadview sits in the middle of a neighborhood where there are homes nearby, children nearby, families nearby, and a church, Welch said, in what should be a place of peace and routine for that community has too often become a place of fear, disruption, trauma, and instability. The legislation is not retroactive, meaning it would not apply to future facilities, but not the existing facility in Broadview or others currently owned or leased by the federal government. The bill is likely to run into legal hurdles. Generally, the federal government is exempt from state and local zoning restrictions. Nearly all Republicans oppose the legislation. Representative Patrick Windhorse, Republican Metropolis, accused Democrats who hold supermajorities in the legislature of continually picking fights with the federal government. The result of this effort to not work together with the federal government to resolve the issues, particularly related to immigration and enforcement of our laws, has resulted in huge problems in our state that the majority party attempts to blame the current presidential administration for, Windhorse said. But we need to take a hard look at what we're doing as a state to make sure we're fulfilling our obligations to protect our citizens and to enforce the laws, including the federal laws of our country. Welch said, it was the other way around. The federal government's picking a fight with us, Welch said. We have states' rights. We know our rights. We know our power. And I wake up every single day saying, thank God I live in Illinois, because we're protecting the people of Illinois. Illinois already bans privately owned immigration detention centers, and under the Illinois Way Forward Act, local governments are prohibited from entering contracts with ICE to detain immigrants for the agency in county jails. Apartment rental fees. One measure passed last week is going to the governor's desk. The House voted 64-40 to pass House Bill 3564, which aims to crack down on the types of fees landlords can charge their renters. The bill prohibits landlords from charging fees of more than $50 for applications, background checks, modifying a lease, making after-hours maintenance requests, or pest abatement or removal, so long as the renter didn't cause the issue. It would also require all mandatory fees to be listed on the first page of a lease, and tenants would not be required to pay any fees that are not listed on that page. I've actually heard from several landlords in the negotiation process of this bill where they have talked about certain bad actors in the industry that are charging these absurd fees that don't make sense. Bill sponsor Representative Nabila Saeed, Democrat, Inverness, said, "They don't make sense to many landlords, and they don't make sense to many tenants. And this is simply trying to remove the ability to put additional fees that are just causing undue burdens on individuals that are looking for housing." Representative Jeff Kiescher, Republican Sycamore, worried the bill would lead to higher rents. Their natural inclination is going to build these costs into the base rent, and therefore the tenants are going to be paying additional higher rents, he said. If signed, the bill would take effect July 1st. High school voter registration. House Bill 4339 would require high schools to offer eligible students the opportunity to register to vote. Although the bill mandates this action, it provides no consequences if a school does not offer that opportunity. The bill passed 77-24 with bipartisan support, although some Republicans expressed concern about nonprofits that schools would partner with, encouraging students to support one political party over another. Sponsor Representative Kimberly DuBucklet, Democrat, Chicago, said the bill intends to increase youth voter registration. This bill was inspired by the Reverend Jesse Jackson Sr., who said, and I quote, "Senior high school graduation must be seen as a passage rite into adulthood. On that graduation day or night, we must put a diploma in one hand, symbolizing knowledge and wisdom, and put a voter registration card in the other hand, symbolizing power and responsibility." That is the heart of this legislation, DuBucklet said. Minimum age of alleged child abuse perpetrators. Under current Illinois law, there is no given age that a minor can be held liable for child abuse. The House voted 102-2 to pass House Bill 4539, seeks to make minimum age for liability 14. The age children can legally stay home alone without supervision. Bill sponsor Representative Barbara Hernandez, Democrat of Aurora, said the measure was initiated by the Illinois Department of Children and Family Services because the department was investigating cases involving alleged perpetrators as young as 6. The bill also seeks to provide guidance to an alleged perpetrator is under 14, in which case the bill directs DCFS to identify if there is an adult or agency whose disregard allowed maltreatment. The Blue Envelope program would provide individuals diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder with blue envelopes that identify them as autistic and provide communication guidance to law enforcement. Under House Bill 4472, sponsored by Representative Michelle Mussman, Democrat, Schaumburg, the Secretary of State would establish, design, and administer the voluntary program. We'll take a short break now and turn to the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review, dated Monday, April 13th, 2026. Please stay tuned.